I guess young people all over the country have relied on Cliff Notes and their very distinctive look, the yellow and the black stripes and so forth. So Spy decided to come up with a satire, not only of Cliff Notes, but of some of the, I guess you call them, Brat Pack novelists.
Brat Pack novels, the young literati of the late 1980s, centered primarily in New York City, Bret Easton Ellis and Tam Ejanowitz, Jay McInerney, and believe it or not, 17 other novels. Some of them written by, you know, one person wrote one or two.
There were some other novels that were by, sure. I guess, some lesser names.
There's some lesser names, you know, Jay McInerney's written three novels himself. He had Bright Lights, Big City, and then his second novel was actually the novel he'd written first that had been rejected by a few publishing houses, and no one wanted it. And then when Bright Lights, Big City took off, they said, well, finish that second one, and that finished the first one, which became his second one, and then he threw together a third one eventually, and he claims he wrote it in between four to 6 weeks, which is seems hard to believe, but when you read the book, it does seem like it was written in about 4 to 6 weeks.
Or less,
yeah. Just kind of stream of consciousness. All the novels are very similar to each other, which is one of the main reasons we decided to satirize them. They're all written by fairly young authors, all about kind of the hip go-go lifestyle in the late 1980s in New York, about drug use and abuse, about, you know, sexual gyrations and staying out every night till 5 and getting fired from your job and hanging out with the cool people, which all sounds very exciting when you read it on the back jacket. But in fact, they're all written in this kind of malaise-filled, angst-filled tone that just goes on and on about basically how sex is no fun, drugs are no fun, living in New York City is no fun, you know.
Well, I have interviewed all three of the major authors here, McInerney, Ejanowitz, and Ellis, and I've enjoyed talking to them. And I've read some, but not all, of their books, and it's hilarious. When you reduce the plot line to the way that you have done in the Spy book, it makes the stories sound absolutely silly.
Well, the stories are absolutely silly, but it takes a close reader to discover that, I think. I mean, we can't say across the board that all these stories are absolutely silly and that each of the novels is poorly written. Some of them are pretty good. Michael Chabon's Mysteries of Pittsburgh is in here. He was kind of unjustly lumped into this crowd because he's a young author and he got a large advance, but it's a very good book. And Susan Minot's Monkeys was a good collection of short stories. But and the first two thirds of Jay McInerney's Bright Lights, Big City weren't that bad at all.
Joe Eisenstadt supposed to be pretty good, but of course,
supposed to be.
Yeah, supposed but, to be. I have the book. I haven't gotten around to reading it yet, but I was able to use Spy a book to know what the plot is. And here we have the two protagonists, the women urinating on the beach.
That's right.
And that seems to be the focus of the book.
Yes, there's a lot of urination in that book, as I recall. The two women urinate on the beach. The one kind of ne'er-do-well kid is urinating on the beach and fantasizing about being able to urinate far enough and with enough force to douse a nearby lighthouse. Someone urinates in a bottle and gives it to someone else at a party. It's almost like L.A. Law, which curiously has a urination fixation. I don't know. I'm baffled. That periodically in these books, you see what the author is trying to do, and they're not doing a very good job. You know, maybe they're trying to show how a troubled childhood can lead to a troubled adulthood or something. But periodically, you come across something like that. You have no idea. It seems to be out of the blue, just kind of the urination theme running throughout the book.
Now, Paul, you had to read all these books.
I did have to read all these books. That's true. I'm probably the world's only expert on the Brat Pack novels, or at least the only person who would admit to that. No, I did have quite a bit of help also from some of our other editorial assistants and reporters at Spy. They each took a book and read it and reported to me, and then I put it down, but no, it was tiring reading all these books. And I'm not, you know, I enjoy reading usually. It's in a way, though, it was exciting and rewarding because we discussed the idea of doing this and said, well, all these books are very similar, you know, in each book the mother dies, in each book this happens, in each book that happens. And it was kind of like a treasure hunt to read, you know, five books, and in the sixth one, yes, you've discovered again, here's the part where the mother dies, here's the part where someone, you know, throws their cocaine down the toilet, you know, just the remarkable, it's almost as if they were written by one author over a period of, 6 to 8 weeks, probably. You know.
Well, you've spared me a lot of agony, because now I can just read your plot outlines here, I know these are plot outlines. I'm not sure the books have much of a plot. There's so much sex in all of these books. I mean, that must be. Of course, I come from another generation. We didn't have it back when I.
Well, that's kind of the notion these books.
I don't
prey
even
on.
Know. I didn't even know how women got pregnant.
Yeah, well,
we just didn't do it.
that's one of the notions these books prey on. They people of your generation, let's say, saying, well, what are the young people doing these days? Why, you know. What's going on? What are they doing in New York? Why are they having so much sex? And out of a curiosity, people pick up one of these books thinking they're going to find out. But the relation these books bear to the real life that they intend to portray is a very tenuous one. I mean, they tend to exaggerate the amount of sex going on, the amount of drug abuse, and also exaggerate the kind of bad mood of today's generation. You know, kids these days aren't, you know, in a constant bad mood and bemoaning the fact that they were born in the wrong age and they'd wish they'd lived in the 40s or some more exciting time. You know, kids are happy these days, is what I'm saying.
Well, one of the younger authors you don't have in here is Kaylee Jones. And
if I'd heard of Kaylee Jones, he or she would have been in here. But she's
teaching up at Columbia. She's written three novels. She's the daughter of the late James Jones.
Oh.
And her first novel had so much sex in it, and so she and I were talking about this. I was interested in talking to her because I had also interviewed her father before his death. And she said, well, Mr. Swaim, I hope I didn't shock you with this book. As if I could be shocked. You have something else that's kind of interesting. This is the spy novel Matic.
That's right.
This is a revolutionary new fiction writing device that lets you plot your very own novel. How does this work exactly?
It's very hard to explain without seeing it, but I can do my best. It's basically a card that has moving...
keeps falling out of the book.
Yeah, moving templates that slide, where different phrases slide into different windows. So basically, you can write your own Brat Pack novel. You have a choice at eight different junctures. For instance, you would start, it says, my novel's main character, and then you would pick either an affluent student at a small college in New England or a hard-drinking young college student with a voracious and indiscriminate sexual appetite, or you could pick, you know, between six others. And then it goes through the book and, you know, what they do. You have a choice at each juncture. You know, we sympathize because the protagonist has just been told that mother and father are getting a divorce or is only doing what everyone else in his or her circle is doing, you know, or six other choices from there. And then finally, at the very end, at the end of your novel, you must end it. If you're going to write a Brat Pack novel, you must end it with a subtle epiphany. And I use the word subtle sarcastically, a subtle epiphany like, after thousands of years of civilization, mankind has finally, just this decade, sunk to a new low. Or one that seems to be very popular in these books, which is Los Angeles or New York is a bad city that can make a person crazy. That, I believe, was the point of Bright Lights, Big City, and Slaves of New York, and Less Than Zero, and quite a few others.
Now, you have some optional extra novelmatic steps, and one of them is call Amanda Binky Urban.
Yes, call Amanda Binky Urban, the super agent to the Brat Pack novelists and many others. She handles McInerney, Ellis, and for a while handled Janowitz. The only way to be sure, of course, is to check the master genre in a nutshell comparison chart, which is also in the spy notes, that lists the book's first line, last line, the author's mentor, the age, the reported publisher's advance, estimated sales, and, of course, sex acts depicted, explicit drug depictions of drug use. You can find it all in this chart. Agent, yep. Amanda Binky Urban, Amanda Binky Urban, Amanda Binky... Oh, Mort Janklow, I guess, was Jill Eisenstadt's agent. Amanda Binky Urban. She handles them all. Yeah, in the first version of the spy novel-o-matic, we actually had call Amanda Binky Urban at ICM, her agency, and we had the phone number there also, but we decided that might be a little bit too much.
You could have put in a wrong digit.
That's true, but then some other poor person would have been getting calls from other young novelists all over the country.
Now, Paul Sims, you're a young writer. You wrote this book. You're a young writer. You don't have any sour grapes now that McInerney and these other writers...
No, I actually don't, because I think this book here is better than each of those other books. So I don't have any sour grapes. I prefer humor to... I don't prefer humor to fiction, but... I think young writers tend to do better writing humor than they do writing fiction that fiction, at least, that attempts to kind of sum up all of the human experience by the age of 25. You know.
Yeah, you know, I was talking, on a more serious note, I was talking to Edward Abbey, the late writer, mm-hmm. and he was saying somebody came up to him at a party and asked him, how long does it take to write a novel? And Abbey said, a lifetime.
That's true.
I thought that was a wonderful, wonderful line. But you're right, these young writers, Ellis, for example, was 21 when he wrote Less Than Zero, mm-hmm. had it published, and... what's going to happen to these young writers in the future? That they're obviously going to are they going to develop and mature, or what? Are they just going to are these flukes and they're just going to vanish?
Who knows? You can't say. And a lot of the fault, you know, this is a satire, but we're just kind of poking fun at them. And I'm sure they're all very nice people. And you would know. I mean, you've talked to them. Not all of this phenomenon is their fault. In fact, much of it isn't. It's every college these days has writing programs and writing classes, and they're probably a good thing, encouraging people to learn how to write. But then there's this whole machinery that kind of gets going. You know, I think each of these was written to some degree in a writing class, and then someone passed it on to an agent, and an agent said, yeah, let's take this, and said, maybe not this is a great novel, but wow, for a 20, 25-year-old kid, this is a very well-written novel. And, you know, and he's a good-looking young kid, maybe, and it's kind of a gimmick or a novelty to have a book out. I mean, that's primarily the attention a lot of these books got, was that they were young novelists, and it was almost like a talking dog or something. You know, you don't care how well he speaks, but that he speaks at all. And then the machinery kind of goes into gear, and I think in some cases McInerney, Ellis, those types of people start to believe themselves that, you know, hey, I am getting as much attention now as Ernest Hemingway or someone like that. You know, maybe it is. Maybe this is justified. But I'm not sure what's going to happen to him. I think some of them, like I said before, Michael Chabon, I think, will do fine. If you'd asked me 3 months ago, I would have said Susan Minot will do fine. But she's had a book come out since we finished this one called Lust, which is not that good.
I read it. I didn't read her first one. I did read the
And what did you think of it?
Well, I didn't identify with the characters very well. And I thought her writing was good. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, I didn't understand the people in it.
Yeah. Well, see, it's almost as if it's the same characters. Her first book was about a family and about a lot of children. It was very, very well written, very evocative prose. And it's almost as if they've grown up now, and those children, those characters, and moved to New York and become just like all the people in the McInerney and Janowitz and other books, which is kind of unfortunate. I don't know. Maybe some of them will prove us wrong and flourish and do something very terrific. It does seem, though, that in the progression, none of these novelists have produced second or third novels as good as their first one. I think they get a little lazy, or they think maybe, you know, I'll be experimental. You know, I've done my legitimate novel. Now I can strike out on my own and be experimental. I mean, Less Than Zero, Brett Ellis's... Less Than Zero was his first book. His second book... The Rules of Attraction was just, had something like, you know, 400 chapters or something, and 17 different narrators, avoided standard rules of punctuation and grammar, and you couldn't really follow what was going on. And I'm sure he was telling himself, I'm kind of pushing the boundaries of what can be done with fiction, when, in fact, he was just confusing readers all over the place.
There were some legal problems with regard to the spy book satire.
There certainly were. Surprisingly to us, Cliff Notes sued us, and won, and even more surprisingly, won an injunction preventing us from distributing the book originally. So we had 125,000 copies of the book sitting in a warehouse somewhere. Their point was that the Spy Notes cover looked much too much like an actual Cliff Notes cover. And a judge agreed with him and decided that it was plausible that someone would go into a bookstore looking for the Cliff Notes to, you know, Madame Bovary, which they had an exam on the next day, and see this and say, well, I'll take Spy Notes instead, which is highly implausible to us. And the Second Circuit Court of Appeals looked at it eventually and said, no, you know, there's room in America for parody and satire. And in fact, parody and satire is protected by the First Amendment and should be strongly protected by it. And they overturned it.
But how could there be any confusion? You've got the word satire at least five times.
That's right, five times on the front, four times on the back. It's we have a spy book in big letters in red, white, and blue, which Cliff Notes never uses. We have a little balloon here that says the spy novel-o-matic device. If we lived in a nation of illiterate book buyers, there could be some confusion. However, if someone's in a bookstore, I believe they know how to read, and they probably know what the words of satire mean.
And I doubt that this would be in the same rack with this. Cliff Notes.
This comes in its very own eye-catching display that should be right up near the register.
You've got to do something about the Novelmatic pullouts there.
They keep sliding out. In the original, when you buy it in the bookstore, there's a little sticker on there that'll hold it.
That's
in.
That's temporary.
Yeah, you can take this once you take it home. You can take the sticker off and start transposing your own novel onto your typewriter, and then call Inky Urban and Gary Fiskejohn.
Tell me about the Spy magazine. Are you on the editorial staff?
Yeah, I'm a staff writer there. Yeah.
I've read Spy magazine a number of times, and I'm baffled.
Baffled?
I'm baffled by it. Tell me about it. I mean, who is it talking to?
It's talking to everyone, but probably more to people who read a few other magazines every week or every month also. Read two or three other magazines. But Spy is basically kind of an antidote to what you see in all other magazines, which are kind of puff pieces. And, you know, if it's a piece about a celebrity, it's kind of an admiring piece. It's everything. It's this kind of... Spy is kind of biting the ankle of the overdog. We go after the big targets and the people that no one else... You know, Donald Trump gets 6 or 7 profiles saying he really is a great guy. Look how he made all this money. He's terrific. And then, you know, he appears in Spy, and he's a short-fingered vulgarian and a Queens-born casino operator, and we kind of it's old-fashioned investigative reporting where it's the writers and the subject of the pieces aren't going hand in hand. It's not, if I'm going to write a piece about someone, I'm not going to call their press agent and say, could I set up an interview, and yes, I promise I won't mention this or that or, you know, this other trouble or this other thing he'd rather not mention. Spy usually does pieces without the help of the subjects and really tries to get at what they're doing and what's really going on.
But Spy has a generally lighthearted tone, doesn't it?
It is. It's lighthearted, and it's amusing. It's
satirical.
It's satirical, yeah. We hesitate to say funny just because then people kind of associate it with the National Lampoon or other, you know, crazy, wacky humor. It's satirical nonfiction journalism with a lighthearted bent. It's what's genuinely funny in the real world.
With a greater degree of sophistication than Lampoon.
Sure, sure.
How did the magazine start?
It started in Graydon Carter and Kurt Anderson, who are my two bosses, sort of, the two editors at Spy, were working at Time magazine, and they met each other and got to talking about how they'd... there was no magazine that was their favorite magazine right now, as National Lampoon in the early 70s had been, or Mad, or, you know, the Esquire of the 60s. And they just sort of discussed quite a few times over lunch, and it was kind of an excuse for just hanging out and drinking, I assume. Discussed what would be in their perfect magazine. You know, what magazine would they really like to see? What magazine would they buy every week if they saw it on the newsstands? And they formulated the ideas and got a little more serious about it. And then Tom Phillips, the publisher now, came in, and they actually decided to go about starting this up.
What is your background, and how did you get involved with Spy?
Well, my background is I was vice president at the Harvard Lampoon, the nation's oldest humor magazine. We did a parody of USA Today in 1986 and a book for Atlantic Monthly Press in 1987 and plus magazines and all that. And I graduated in 1988, and I thought, well, where do I want to work? And I thought the best place to work, the best magazine that's out there, the best place to write that's out there is Spy Magazine. And
so you said, Spy, I'm coming.
Spy, I'm coming. Hold a place for me. No, you know, I interviewed and told him I loved it and talked to him and all that. And I'd met Kurt beforehand because he had been an editor of the Harvard Lampoon years and years before when I was, you know, still a kid or something. But I talked to him and gave him story ideas and ended up there.
Harvard grads have Spy locked up?
No, they don't, actually, although that's the thing I keep hearing. No, there are a few of us working there, you know, a few Harvard grads and a few Yale grads and a few Duke grads, a few, you know, wherever. The people from Spy tend to come from all over the place. In fact, it is funny, there's a high concentration, I suppose, as there is at every magazine, of non-New Yorkers. We have maybe 3 people working there who actually were born and raised in New York. And yet the magazine is the New York Monthly, and we try to stay pretty much about New York. So,
Are you planning other satirical projects?
Yes, we are. I'm not sure what's next. I mean, we have a whole roster of satirical books and other books lined up. I know eventually, somewhere down the line, will be the follow-up to Separated at Birth, which was the first spy book, which saying the name, no one will recognize. If I say it's that book that has a funny picture of, like, a celebrity and then another celebrity who looks just like him, people go, oh, yeah, I've seen that. So there'll be a follow-up to that, and there'll be a few others. I don't know how much detail I can go into, but I know one of the next ones will be a comprehensive and slightly satirical resource book. That's about as close as I can.
Resource
book.
All right. Is Doubleday the prime publisher for the spy
books?
Yes,
they are. Doubleday and Spy have a nice partnership going with these books. In fact, when the lawsuit for Spy Notes was against Doubleday, and Spy was merely an interested party, so Doubleday bailed themselves out of the hot water.
You know, they didn't have Cliff Notes when I was in college. We had to rely on the classic comics.
Oh, I
Classics Illustrated.
Yeah. Well, that's not a bad idea. A Classics Illustrated version of Bright Lights, Big City would be very funny.
Wouldn't it?
If only it were still around. All right, I'll give you 5%. We'll go ahead and do it.
Well, Paul Sims, my last question. When are you going to write your own Bright Lights, Big City?
Oh, boy. Maybe a few years from now when I'm really down in the dumps and have nothing better to do and have lost all self-respect.
Well, I bet you have a lot of ammunition, all those big drinking parties at the Harvard Lampoon.
Yeah, that's true, but you can't write about things like that and expect anyone else to be interested. Those are just happy memories for me.
Well, Jay McInerney did.
Yes, and no one else was interested. So, I'm sure Jay McInerney did have quite a fun time riding around in limousines in New York or riding around in cabs and doing drugs or you know, dancing with models, and he should have just kept it to himself and counted his blessings every night and thought about how the good old days were rather than putting it down on paper.
Paul Sims, Spy Notes, hilarious book. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.